Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Jody Cowan. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Joel Berg, director of Hungry Free America, who was in Albany last week to kick off a 20-state anti-hunger tour. Then Ewan Renfro of the Empire Justice Center talks about the push to have the New York State legislature pass the Gender Recognition Act. Later on, we'll hear from those who attended a demonstration in Townsend Square in Albany last Friday evening regarding the current Palestinian-Israeli conflict. After that, Marissa Peck, Retail Markets Director for Capital Roots, discusses urban farming and food justice initiatives. Finally, we hear about one of those urban farming initiatives in Troy, Aaron Jonas, who is joining us as a garden coordinator in the College City Garden. We welcome her and her ambitions for the coming seasons. But first, here's the headlines.
With the legislative session in its final week, the Times Union reports that releasing aging people in prison are still hoping to pass several parole reform measures, including making it easier for those over 55 years old to be released. Another proposal, the Fair and Timely Parole Act, would mandate the parole board to release any incarcerated person who is eligible for release on parole, unless that person represents a current risk that cannot be reduced by parole supervision in New York State.
Governor Cuomo says he'll lift many pandemic-related health measures if New York's COVID-19 vaccination rate, currently at 68.6% statewide, reaches 70%. He predicted the state will reach that level of vaccination in 8 days. Cuomo also reversed the position and said that schools will need to require masks inside through the end of the school year since there are only 2 weeks left.
The Gazette reports that the Schenectady City School District's mobile library is set to hit the streets Wednesday after upgrades to a donated school bus and an expansion of a diverse collection of books.
State lawmakers have passed legislation expanding the Secure Choice Savings Program to require that companies with at least 10 employees that do not currently offer their workers a way to save for retirement enroll each worker in an IRA under the program unless a worker opts out. The bill would add 2.5 million workers to an existing program started in 2018.
And our last headline, helping New York kids cope with lingering trauma of COVID, comes to us from Public News Service.
As the pandemic wanes, experts say it's important to recognize the impact of the fear, loss, and isolation it caused on children's mental health. Data from the Children's Hospital Association shows between April and October last year, hospitals saw a 24% increase in mental health emergency visits by kids age 5 to 11, and for ages 12 to 17, the increase was 31%. But parents may not always recognize the symptoms of trauma and grief. In a webinar on Helping Our Children Navigate Through Trauma, Dr. Shay Lott with the Stephen A. Cohen Military Family Clinic at Easterseals points out that children experience grief differently than adults.
For children, you typically will get a lot of physical symptoms like headaches, stomach aches, and those kinds of things, not wanting to do things that they usually enjoy.
New Yorkers can find resources for helping children and families cope with COVID-related stress and trauma through the New York State Office of Mental Health online at nyprojecthope.org. Dawn Kahn, who lives in Manhattan, is the parent of two teenagers. Khan says she began to notice changes in her 15-year-old daughter's behavior and outlook last summer.
She's definitely exhibited signs of depression. Her interpersonal relationships have suffered. She's much more withdrawn than she used to be.
She says her daughter has been seeing a therapist, and with schools reopening, she's beginning to reengage socially and appears to be happier. But Vicky Jay, CEO of the National Alliance for Grieving Children, notes the upheaval of the pandemic has impacts that will last a lifetime, and it has affected everyone.
We've all experienced loss and change and disappointment and trauma this year, and it's not going to be over with. There's not a switch to flip. It becomes a part of who we are, and it's what we take forward with us.
In a recent poll by the American Psychiatric Association, 48% of parents said the pandemic has contributed to mental health problems for at least one of their children. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. Host Joel Berg, director of Hunger Free America, was in Albany last week to kick off a 20-state anti-hunger tour. He discusses the continuing hunger program, the need for living wage jobs, universal health care, and a higher minimum wage, with Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined today by Joel Berg, who is the head of Hunger Free America, and he was recently in Albany to kick off a nationwide tour trying to draw attention to the fact that, unfortunately, hunger still exists in America. So, Joel, what was your message in Albany?
Well, my message was that it's great that charities like Arbor Hill Community Food Pantry is filling in the gaps, and the food pantries of the Capital Region are filling in the gaps. But the real answer to ending hunger in the Albany region and throughout the country is to create an economy with living wage jobs that ensures health care is free and childcare and housing are affordable, and then there's an adequate safety net like SNAP. Congressman Paul Tonko joined us, as did a state senator and the county executive from Albany County, all highlighting the role that government's playing in addressing this crisis. And we've seen that the safety net really has expanded dramatically in the last year. And I want to be clear, that's not just cyclical, that's not just accidental, that was because of governmental actions of the congressional leadership in the Biden administration.
Well, I was listening to some newscasts over the weekend, and I guess a congresswoman from Connecticut was making the point that during the COVID crisis, we really expanded the SNAP program during the summer months. But I think overall, just because, you know, children had less access to the school meal program, and she wants to make it permanent. Is that getting serious consideration by the Biden administration and Senator Schumer?
Well, it's certainly getting serious attention by Senator Gillibrand and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who have proposed a bill to allow you create universal free school meals throughout the year. And there's a lot of talk about the so-called pandemic EBT program, which was created to provide meals when schools are closed, making that permanent. So we will see. I will tell you, even though these programs expanded rapidly and reduced hunger in New York State a little bit from its pandemic high, in 1 week in May, 1.4 million state residents didn't have enough to eat in just 1 week. 1.4 million state residents. Right. And you know, the governor focuses a lot on the Nourish New York State program, which is, you know, buying food from farmers to give out to food pantries and soup kitchens. That's fine. But this year, the SNAP program in New York is going to spend maybe $7 billion. The SNAP program used to be called the food stamp program. And so even if you increase that by just a few percent, it will absolutely dwarf every other effort. In Albany County alone, in February, SNAP provided 34,000 people with $7.5 million worth of benefits in February. So, you know, the Greek mathematician and scientist Archimedes said, if you give me a lever big enough, I can move the world. You know, when it comes to fighting hunger, the biggest lever is the economy and ensuring there are enough jobs that pay a living wage and ensuring that things like health care is free and child care and transportation and housing are affordable. But then there's got to be an adequate safety net, and that simply dwarfs all the great work even the best run charities in the planet are able to provide.
So what are some of the job creation proposals that Hunger Free America is hoping to, get Congress and the Biden administration to enact in the near future?
Well, we are proposing a food jobs program to ensure that more locally based people can create jobs, particularly in food processing. I know in your previous work with Hunger Hatching at Work in New York State, you had some experience with doing food processing. It's very difficult, but if we have it better funded by the federal government and better marketing at federal, state, and local levels, we can reduce food waste and create living wage jobs. In addition, we've proposed a way to index the minimum wage nationwide to medium household income by county. We've proposed it in a way that might pass Joe Manchin's test because it would raise the minimum wage to about $11 an hour in West Virginia, what he said he would support, and it would further raise the minimum wage in New York. We definitely need to, and Governor Cuomo can do this with just a pen, eliminate this ridiculous subminimum wage we have in New York for tipped workers. The New York Times just ran a story that tips have gone down significantly since the pandemic has ebbed because people, at least the people who can give tips and are wealthy enough to eat out are thinking it's no longer an emergency. So not only do we need to create jobs, we need to ensure that the jobs that do exist, including so-called tip jobs, pay a living wage so people can earn enough to feed their families.
Well, speaking of, you know, tip wages, about $1 billion is stolen annually from the lowest income workers in New York State, particularly in New York City. And, you know, this national mobilization against sweatshop and legal aid has been pushing for years the sweat bill. In fact, Governor Cuomo vetoed it on New Year's Day 2 years ago. Have you guys looked at all at the wage step issue?
Oh, that's a huge issue. First and foremost, we need comprehensive, fair immigration reform that allows people a step towards citizenship. The reality is a lot of people who are getting their wages stolen are undocumented immigrants, and their employers know it, and they can use that as leverage. So that's one. And number two, every level of government, the federal, state, and county governments, and here in New York City, where I'm based, need to do a more thorough job at wage enforcement. I personally have friends of mine who've been ripped off by their employers, gone months without being paid. And there's not nearly as much enforcement as that needs to be. That's basically, you know, theft of a mass level of wages people earn. So it's bad enough that the minimum wage is only $15 an hour, rising to that in much of the state. It's worse that so many people officially work for less than minimum wage, but it's truly appalling how many people don't get paid at all or get paid even less than those very, very, very meager crumbs of wages that are under state law now. So that is a big issue.
So what can people in the Capital District listening to this show do to help end hunger in New York and America?
They can go to hungerfreeamerica.org, www.hungerfreeamerica.org, find out how they can donate money, find out how they can volunteer, find out how they can advocate. They can contact Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand and their local congresspeople like Paul Tonko to thank them for their leadership on these issues and tell them to keep them up. They can also contact Governor Cuomo and tell him to place more of an effort on helping people access SNAP and WIC, which are funded by the federal government. And if they have any relatives in West Virginia, well, that's another conversation.
Now, I know a couple of years ago, you know, Hunger Free America was primarily based in New York City. I guess it's still where your base is, but you, you know, try to expand to a more nationwide movement. Probably one of the reasons you're going on a 20-state tour. How is Hunger Free America coming as a national organization or movement at this point?
It's going well. We now run the National Hunger Hotline on behalf of USDA, where people can call 1-866-3-HUNGRY, including in the Albany area, and find out where they can get food. We have a nationwide AmeriCorps VISTA program, sort of a domestic Peace Corps. We started pilot projects to do nonpartisan voter mobilization last fall. We're creating food action boards to engage people with lived experience and leadership roles in the fight against hunger. And as you mentioned, I am doing a 20-state, 8,000-mile tour by car this summer to really highlight these solutions. So as you know, it's a lot of tough work raising the money to do advocacy. Many more funders want to fund the direct food distribution, even though that's not the greatest answer to hunger. So while fundraising is a challenge, a lot of people around the country know we need a change. They see some positive things are happening in Washington, and they're a little less cynical than they may have been in the past. Maybe they don't think it's all hopeless. Maybe they do understand now that public health policy can improve.
We've been talking with Joel Berg, the head of Hunger Free America. In the last 30 seconds, you mentioned these local hunger boards. And I know you, in the past, you tried to get the consumers of emergency food programs more active in the hunger movement. How's that going in 30 seconds?
It's very tough to do. It takes money and time, and we want to compensate people, but no social movement in the history of the world has been won by one people on behalf of another. There's no way we can end hunger without people who experience hunger and have experienced hunger being in leadership roles. So it's hard to do, but we must do it.
Your website?
Hungerfreeamerica.org.
Thank you very much, Joel Berg, and this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Joel Berg of Hunger Free America talking about the challenges and their many programs with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunlay. That website, once again, is www.hungerfreeamerica.org.
In the final days of New York's legislative session, advocates are pushing to pass the Gender Recognition Act, to pass the Gender Recognition Act into law. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Corinne Casey talks with Ewan Renfro of the Empire Justice Center about the act.
Ewan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Corinne.
There are just a few days left in the 2021 legislative session, and you are trying to pass a bill called the Gender Recognition Act. Can you tell me what that bill would do?
Yeah, so this is a comprehensive bill that'll take a lot of the disparate and different and complicated ways that transgender and non-binary folks have to go through to update their gender identity documents and remove a lot of the barriers and complications that go with that. Right now, it's really hard to update your documents with your correct name and your correct gender. We're in a space where New York, which is supposedly one of the most progressive states in the country, we've got a space where literally only 12% of trans New Yorkers have been able to update all of their documents. And 63% haven't been able to update any at all. So this is a huge problem for folks who are trying to just live their lives. If you're trying to get an apartment, if you're trying to register for school or register your kids for school, if you're trying to travel anywhere, if you're trying to get medical care, having accurate identity documents is like so important to all of that. You know, even if you're just trying to get served in a store or a restaurant, if you have mismatching ID, it really, really increases the chances that you're going to face discrimination, harassment, even sometimes physical assault. Literally like 34% of trans folks in New York who present mismatching ID, so like ID that doesn't align with their gender presentation, have faced these issues.
Over the past several years, administrative agencies in New York have opened up ways that people can change their gender identity on their identification documents. So if that's the case, then what are the barriers that people currently face?
Well, that's true to a certain extent. Some barriers have been removed. I mean, the big one is that just the last few years, the requirement for proof of surgery has been removed from most documents. And that was hugely invasive, obviously, which cost a lot of money for folks and really conflated like somebody's gender identity to a surgical procedure, which is not the lived experience of most people. But there's still a lot of barriers, and they tend to be financial because the trans community is like overwhelmingly very poor. And also, there's all these different ways that folks have to do this. So each place is requiring different things. So if you're trying to get your birth certificate in New York State updated, there's a different procedure than if you're trying to get your birth certificate from New York City updated. If you're trying to get your driver's license updated, that's a different procedure from your birth certificate. If you're trying to get your marriage certificate updated, there is literally no way to do that. You have to actually divorce and remarry. So there are huge barriers in place. Some of the things that the Gender Recognition Act will do to fix that is to remove some of these financial barriers. One is for name changes, folks have to like publish their name in the newspaper. and a lot of other personal information about themselves. So that's a financial barrier, but it's also a safety barrier for a lot of folks.
And a privacy barrier.
Yeah, it's privacy, and that very quickly for trans folks, it translates to safety. You know, if you're publishing, "Hi, I'm transgender," in your local newspaper, that can really be a problem for certain communities. The bill also adds an ex-gender marker option for birth certificates and for driver's licenses. And that is a huge win for non-binary workers. So that's folks who don't identify as either male or female necessarily and want something that is a more gender-neutral designation that more closely aligns with their identity. There's already over 20 states that allow ex-gender markers, so New York is pretty far behind here. In fact, we are behind ourselves in that New York City also allows ex-gender markers on birth certificates, but New York State does not. Well, until recently did not, but it is still very difficult to access because it is a purely administrative process that's very difficult to find information for. And that's one of the things that the bill will do once it's passed and made into laws, make all these processes much easier to access and much easier to go through.
Where is the bill right now? Does it look like it has a shot of passing before the end of the session?
Yeah, we're actually in a fantastic space to be in the last week of legislative session. We are in the Assembly. We just went through the Ways and Means Committee today and opened the path to the floor. In the Senate, we're just waiting. We're already on third reading there. So we're just waiting for the bill to be added to the active list. So we are very well placed. However, you know, it's the end of session. There's only 3 days left. And so a lot of bills are potentially in our position, and not all of them are going to make it through because there's only so many hours left of the legislative session.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Ewan Renfro from Empire Justice Center. We're talking about the Gender Recognition Act that's pending before the New York State Legislature.
Our coalition that's working on the bill is quite big and very diverse, and we've got all sorts of different folks who are involved, lots of legal services folks, lots of LGBT groups and civil rights groups like Lambda Legal, Transgender Law Center, Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, and New York-based trans groups like the New York Transgender Advocacy Group, Gender Equality New York, and of course my organization, Empire Justice Center. So many people who have been working for several years to pull together all of these different pieces for birth certificates, name changes, driver's licenses, all these different things, and fix all of the problems in all of these different areas. IDs feel like they feel like very run-of-the-mill to folks who have easy access to them, right? So if you're not in a space where you've never been able to get one, or you haven't had barriers to getting one, don't know how often it comes up in life and how important it is to have something that accurately reflects your identity so that you can be safe, so that you can get an apartment, so that you can go to school. For myself, I am one of the folks in New York who has been able to update some, but not all, of my own documents because it is very complicated to do it. So, you know, I'm one of the folks who's going to be very happy when we're able to finally pass this bill.
Another important piece of this legislation is that it would allow a parent to choose their own designation on their own child's birth certificate. Can you explain what that means and why it's important?
Yeah, that's again, one of these like very like technical issues, but that has an everyday impact on tons of trans people across New York State. If you're a transgender person and you are a parent, you have to use your child's birth certificate in all sorts of ways, including registering them for school. And if you're trying to register them for school and your name and gender marker on their birth certificate does not match who you are now, that immediately outs you to the school administrators that can put a target on your child's back, depending on the school climate. That can be an issue for the child themselves when they're trying to go to school. If there are kids there who, you know, are not going to be welcoming or accepting, again, it's a privacy issue. This is a thing that trans folks are, unfortunately, we're far too used to, which is constantly being outed by paperwork. You know, it comes up in all these different places. And sometimes years later, something will just hook up to something else that hasn't been updated. And then suddenly, you know, you're getting mail with your old name 24-year-old honorific on it that can out you again at work, at school. We're living in a space now where trans folks are more visible than we have ever been before, but visibility does not translate to safety. And we need safety. We need shelter. We need food. We need healthcare, you know, and these are all of the things that relate to how can I get those things? You know, our documents are part of that.
What can listeners who care about this issue and want to help pass this bill do?
The best thing you can do is to contact your representatives. We actually have a form set up on our website at empirejustice.salsalabs.org/pass the NYS Gender Recognition Act. If you go there, you'll be able to input your name and address. It'll pull up exactly who your legislators are, and you can have an email set up and sent straight to them saying, hey, I need this bill to be passed this session. I need it to be passed this week. This is why it's important to me. This is why it's important to my community. This is why it will affect my family, my coworkers. You know, we're at the very end of the legislative session, so every voice really counts.
Every voice counts. Well, thank you so much for explaining this bill and what people can do to help. I'd love to have you back when the bill passes and we're looking at implementation.
Thank you. I mean, that is extremely my hope as well. So let's try and make it happen.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Corinne Carey talking with Ewan Renfro from the Empire Justice Center about the Gender Recognition Act and efforts to get it passed by the New York State Legislature. For more information, we've included that long website in the story description on our website.
And for those just tuning in, I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
On Friday the 4th, at a demonstration in Townsend Park and Townsend Square in Albany, activists voiced their feelings and passions regarding the current Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In this on-the-scene report, Andrea Conleaf spoke with a number of participants and organizers about their concerns. Kaylin McPherson assisted with this report.
I'm Andrea from Hudson Mohawk Magazine, radio station at WOOC 105.3. You're here for the Palestinian purpose.
Yeah, my name is Tom Ellis. I live in Albany, and I've been a member of the Palestinian Rights Committee since 1982 when I helped organize it. And so we've been around a long time, and we're here today to mark the 54th anniversary of the 1967 Israeli War, where they defeated Arab nations. It was a smashing victory for the Israelis. They occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights. And during that war, they also attacked an American warship in broad daylight under clear skies, killing 34 American soldiers and injuring 170 others. And the United States did not punish Israel for that, which was kind of surprising. Both countries have been lying about it ever since. But getting back to the Palestinians, Palestinians have lived under 54 years of martial law in the West Bank. The Israelis carved out and greatly expanded what they call East Jerusalem. And within a month, they were demolishing homes in East Jerusalem.
Why are you personally involved in this?
I think that I've always had a lot of empathy for people who are being abused. And so I had a lot of empathy for Jewish people as a young person and still do because of the Holocaust. And when I first met Palestinians in 1982, I realized that almost everything I had ever heard or read about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was either half true or not at all true, and that the Palestinians weren't these monsters and terrorists that they were often portrayed as, but that they were victims of the Israelis and the Zionists. And so it just became an important thing for me to work on and to learn about. And so I'm pleased to have been doing it all these years.
You will continue this fight.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Palestine!
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 Free Palestine!
Free Palestine! Your name?
Oh, Atifa DeRosi.
And you're holding a sign that says Kurds and Afghans for Palestine.
Yes, me and my friend made it, who's sitting next to me.
I'm the friend.
Hi, friend.
Hi.
Your name again?
My name's Ella.
Ella, nice to see you. And what brought
nice
you here
too.
Today?
Well, we came in support of Palestine. We weren't sure if a lot of people would be showing up, and we had time, so we decided why not.
Is this an issue that's important to you?
Definitely.
Definitely.
Why is it important to you?
You can go ahead.
Well, as a Kurd, I definitely know what it's like to have somebody take your land and ethnically cleanse you and take away your rights as a human being just for who you are as an ethnicity and a race. And I can definitely relate to the Palestinian struggle. And just seeing what has been going on the past month has been so heartbreaking. And I think it's just wrong to not speak about it, especially when our government, our tax dollars, are actively contributing to said genocide and said ethnic cleansing.
That's a bit of support there, isn't it? And what is this a similar reason that you're here today?
Yes. So we're both actually parts of minority groups. Both of our peoples are being ethnically cleansed, and we know what it's like to not have anybody speak out for you and have this systematically going on, and there's nobody defending you.
Here today at the square in Albany, holding a sign that says, Troy for Black Lives stands with Palestine and other things. What is your name?
My name is Luz Marquez Bembo.
And you live in Troy?
I live in Troy, yes indeed. And I'm one of the founders of Troy for Black Lives, and we're just here to show solidarity with other Troy folks.
I think there is another Troy person here.
Melissa Bromley.
I've also, you know, produced interviews for the Hudson Mohawk magazine, but today I'm here as a protester and as a Jew in solidarity with Palestinians who are living under Israeli occupation.
That's an important thing to do, to stand how you believe. How do you feel about the way Israel is behaving recently?
I think it's an ongoing travesty. That, you know, the word is Nakba. And I hope that with increased attention, we can put pressure on the Israeli state to liberate the Palestinians from Israeli occupation.
How do you feel representing yourself here, and how does that apply to how you feel about Israel?
You know, it's a very emotional issue for me. I have Israeli family. My family was, you know, had an active role, my personal family, in the formation of the Israeli state. And it's heartbreaking for me. And I can relate to the fear that drives the aggression. And I just would wish that my Jewish family could be free from, there's valid fear, but we need to transcend our fear in order to make sure that we're not perpetuating the same kinds of horrors that have been inflicted on the Jewish people for centuries.
Thank you.
If you're not also standing up for Haitians and the people in Colombia and Myanmar and Afghanistan and Yemen, then, and you're only talking about Israel and Palestine, that's a very scary thing for Jewish people.
My name is Iyad Al-Karabi. I am a Palestinian community activist, and I wear many names, and I have many hats in different various movements.
People not forget that there is an issue such as Palestine, where for 70-plus years, my people have been ethnically cleansed, attacked, dismantled, and our homes and villages were burned down.
And you want the world to know. You want more of the world to know.
More of the world to know. I want the capital of the region to know that there is a movement to free Palestine in the capital region, and we are going to be steadfast in building a movement, steadfast, and speaking on Palestine, speaking on other issues that connect with it these days.
Is there other things that we can do as a general public to support this issue?
Show up to protests.
Is there a website?
The U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, the Palestinian Youth Movement, Abdullah Justice New York, Al-Auda, the Right of Return, the Palestinian Rights Command in the Capital Region, groups like that. My group, Palestinian Empowerment Network, which is an LGBT Palestinian group. And those are some groups to get involved with. Jewish Voice for Peace.
Is this going to be a weekly event you're hoping for?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that more people will join and it will be a weekly demonstration.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Keegan Gwynn. I'm from the Answer Coalition.
What is the Answer Coalition?
Answer Coalition is a group that was formed after 9/11 to oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq and continues to fight against all U.S. invasions and occupations overseas.
So why are you here for this particular cause?
I mean, this is one of the most blatant examples of apartheid and genocide that's currently happening on the planet, and especially because the U.S. government is backing the Israeli government fight against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, because it's the most blatant example of apartheid and genocide currently happening, and the U.S. government supports Israel and is complicit in this genocide.
Do you have particular ties with the Middle East or with Palestine? Is there something specific that you are most concerned with?
I do not have any familial connection to the region, but ever since I've learned about what's happening over there to the Palestinians, it's been something I've cared about, because, I mean, really what got me involved in, actively engaged in politics and activism was the murder of George Floyd last summer and the Black Lives Matter movement. That's what actually got me motivated to be in the streets and to talk to people and try to actually make a difference.
This has been Andrea Cunliffe, broadcasting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Andrea Cunliffe talking with participants during Friday's demonstration in Albany regarding the current Palestinian-Israeli conflict. For more information, visit websites for the Palestinian Rights Committee of the Capital Region, Palestinian Youth Movement, Jewish Voice for Peace, the Answer Coalition, or any of the other organizations mentioned. Thanks to Kaylin McPherson for his help with this report.
Access to substantial amounts of nutritious food is essential for maintaining one's physical and mental health. Sadly, there are many people who lack access to healthy food via mainstream food production pipelines. Urban farming and food justice initiatives seek to remedy this issue by bringing more agency in and access to food production, which can help improve people's health and build community. Marissa Peck, Retail Markets Director of Capital Roots, discusses with McKenna Connors these topics and the goals of Capital Roots.
My name is Marissa Peck, and I'm currently the Retail Markets Director at Capital Roots. I've been working with Capital Roots since 2014. I started with the AmeriCorps Vista program, working with development in our office. And then in 2016, I was the food assessment coordinator to conduct the Greater Capital Region Food System Assessment, which we published in January of 2021.
Awesome. So what are the goals of Capital Roots?
Great question. So the mission of Capital Roots is to nourish healthy communities by providing access to fresh food and green spaces for all. And we do that through an array of food access programs that help people access affordable and quality healthy food with dignity. And we also work to preserve and conserve land for people to grow their own food on, and that's through our community gardens program. So we're working in access both in providing retail markets for our for members across the Capital District who are living in sort of low healthy food access areas, but really for all members of the Capital District, and also providing access to land for people to grow their own food.
Awesome. So Do you think urban farming efforts could really help communities that are living in places like food deserts?
Absolutely. I think that in communities where there are active and vibrant urban farming projects, we see the positive results. Even just people who are walking by a space that is cultivated with food and flowers, that is, you know, the baseline benefit is just the environmental enhancement that it brings to a neighborhood or a community. And then everything that trickles out of that, the educational component, the food access component, the environment, the positive attributes for the environment, whether it's rainwater mitigation or creating habitat for native plants and animals, sort of everything sort of trickles out from there to have wonderful impacts for people living in urban areas.
Definitely. What are your thoughts on how food accessibility can impact both individuals and communities?
Well, I think that food access is a right, and it's a right that every member of our communities deserves to have, no matter their age or their income level or their ability to move around their spaces and their neighborhoods. And so I think from there, our work and the job that we all have as, you know, citizens and participants of these communities is to increase that access and address the needs when the access is not being met.
Yeah, especially since, you know, good quality food is so pertinent to overall health.
Exactly. You know, good quality food that is grown in a way that's also supporting the people that grow it and the land that it's grown on is one of the fundamental aspects of human life. And so the more that we can work to reintegrate that into where we're living and the people we're living with, the healthier and happier, hopefully, we all become.
Yeah, definitely. In what ways do you think food accessibility and urban farming can be promoted?
I think there's a number of ways, and we also can look to our own communities where we have vibrant urban farms and also in other places in New York or across the country and in other countries as well. Some of it has to do with having support from the municipality in terms of zoning and creating, you know, the planning departments in cities and towns, helping them have the capacity to fully embrace urban farming initiatives and be able to not let policies sort of get in the way of the projects. So, you know, working with government, I think, is really important for urban farming initiatives and having governments that want to work with urban farming projects. It goes both ways. Additionally, I think just having community support and people who are interested in coming out and shopping at an urban farm stand or volunteering with an urban farming project or sharing with their neighbor something that they got at a farm and telling them to check out the farm stand. Those are all really also important ways. So it's sort of the people thing is really important to bring life to the projects.
Totally. Do you have any suggestions for people who are attempting urban farming or food justice efforts?
It's a great question. I haven't really thought about that yet. But I guess if I'm just thinking and speaking sort of from the heart, my first suggestion is like, keep it going. Great job. Thank you so much. And thank you for your work. And your work is always needed, so please keep doing it. And then also, who can you work with and how can you grow your network of support? Do you know somebody or is there a project out there that's already done something that you're working on and how can you learn from them and support them and do some cross promotion? You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. Let's be smart with how we build upon what already exists and try to help grow and create a network of urban farming and gardening projects that are fully supporting each other.
Yeah, totally. So What are your thoughts on how, you know, community plays a part in food production and, you know, growth of plants and food products?
I think community is the key to that. We have historically, the world and different societies have been operating as subsistence farmers, where they're growing food for themselves, their families, their neighbors, and then for people in their communities or in neighboring communities. And there's a lot of places in the world where that is still the case, although there has not been a lot of support of that at a governmental level in history. And yet those are the people that are feeding the world. And so I think that the more that we can recognize the importance of communities being able to feed themselves with the food that they want, that's good for them and for their culture and for their animals and everything that is growing and living around them. The more that we can recognize and support that, that work, and also help people reconnect with that work, the more we will make progress towards creating autonomous communities that are thriving and they're healthy and they're vibrant and they are, you know, also living with more respect for what the earth and the planet needs as well.
That was Marissa Peck from Torres Capital Roots talking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's McKenna Connors about food justice and urban farming initiatives. For more information, see www.capitalroots.org.
And for our final segment, we'll look at one urban farming initiative in Troy by the Sanctuary for Independent Media called the Collar City Growers Garden. Aaron Johans recently joined the Sanctuary family as the garden coordinator. Aaron spoke with our producer, Sina Bazila Hickey, about her ambitions to use the garden as a food source for the community and her hopes that local residents will come to see the garden as theirs too.
Hi, my name is Aaron Johans, and I'm the 2021 Garden Coordinator for Collar City Growers, and I'm in the L lot on the Sanctuary for Independent Media campus. Collar City Growers is just a few hundred feet to the left of me.
You mentioned the L lot, but there are other gardens. Could you go over what are the different garden lots that the sanctuary owns and that you're overseeing?
So I'm just mainly working on the main Collard City Growers location. That's at 3337 6th Ave in Troy. It's on the same block as the new Nature Lab. And the L lot is kind of this permaculture forest in the middle of a very urban area. So while this area might not be as much for planting vegetables to give back to the community, it still provides a lot of useful space for pollinators that we need in the garden. It provides a lot of beauty in the neighborhood as well. And it's also a home for our bees. Mainly right now, I'm working, like I said, at the Collard City Growers main garden location. So this is my first year and I'm growing food for the community, and it's a space in which I am taking it over after some amazing other garden coordinators in the past. Christian and Azare are a couple of whom who started this garden and who have done a really great job with it as a permaculture space. Most of my experience is within sustainable agriculture, and so that's kind of what I'm bringing to this garden. Fighting food insecurity and getting fresh, healthy produce to people who need it, especially in a food desert area, is something that is very important to me, and that's really something that I want to focus on within this role for this growing season and also in my career in general. Food insecurity is when you might be surrounded by options. There might be grocery stores within your area, but you might have difficulty accessing that. And that can be due to finances, that can be due to different constraints like not having a vehicle, not having a grocery store within walking distance. That can make it hard to access that food. Or you might have something like a bodega in your neighborhood that is going to offer a lot of really calorically dense foods, but it's not going to necessarily offer you food that meets your nutritional needs. And a lot about fighting hunger isn't just necessarily getting calories to people, but it's also making sure that they have access, again, to those fresh, healthy foods that is going to help them in the long run fighting other diseases like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, things like that. So I would really want with this position, or my one goal is to be able to connect to people who are directly in the neighborhood. I would love for people in the neighborhood to feel a sense of ownership with this space, that this isn't something that's just kind of there like another office building that they might walk by every day but they don't really touch, but to be able to invite people more into this space.
We can hear that there are some birds in the background tweeting. We can hear the motorcycles and the buses in the background. So you can hear that this isn't an urban landscape. Could you talk about the importance of having these green spaces between the concrete and in this urban environment?
Definitely. I really think that it is important for people to be able to have that beauty. And a lot of urban spaces are criticized for maybe having beautiful buildings, but not having as much of that nature, which is where I think a lot of people feel the need to go out of the city to go on hikes. But it's also really important to remember that nature is not just something that exists in this out there other space outside of the city. We still have populations of insects and pollinators and other animals that are just as much a part of this urban ecosystem, even if we might be encroaching on their territory and limiting their amount of space. There still exists this balance of flora and fauna, and so I think it's important to be able to have that for its own merit, but also so that way people can still enjoy this space and come in and visit. I would definitely want the L lot in the garden to be something where people could just drop in and even sit down on a chair or a bench and just, you know, quietly read a book or meditate or just enjoy being around, again, more of that green space, especially if you are living in an area where you might not have a backyard. While the space with Collard City Growers is primarily centered around permaculture, I am mainly here to try and grow food for the community. And there are a lot of really great things that we have that kind of blend both that permaculture aspect and also getting food to people. We have things like asparagus and rhubarb. We have a lot of things that will go to seed, like our brassicas, like kale and collards, that will then plant themselves again for the next year. So it's something where, while we are growing food, it's not going to be the same as growing it in a more farm-like environment where we are constantly pulling things out. We really want the plants to kind of exist harmoniously together with crop rotation and also with companion planting and plants that are really going to help support each other.
Can you go into some of your background, what brought you to this garden and some of your garden experience?
Sure thing. So I am a graduate of environmental studies, which can be a very general degree. There's a lot of different things that you can do with it, but I chose to really focus on sustainable agriculture because I had started one of my first jobs was when I was 16 working on an organic farm. And while I really loved that job, it was something where I kind of noticed that a lot of that organic food was catered to a more wealthy clientele, and that really spurred this passion for food justice because I felt as though the people who maybe needed this fresh, healthy produce the most weren't necessarily the ones who had access to that or access to those green spaces, which can be really therapeutic. I volunteer at a couple of other spaces in my free time. One of those places is actually in Albany, where I live, and that is Gabby's Garden with the Albany Free School. I started volunteering there, I would say, back in the summer of 2019, but I really took off as a volunteer in 2020 due to the pandemic, and I found that it was a great way for me to stay connected with my neighbors, even if we weren't necessarily visiting as much. I really liked getting the chance to be outside, and it even helped me in terms of the passage of time. I know it's something with a lot of people where, as COVID has gone on, they talk about how time just feels like it's sort of breaking down. A lot of time passes very quickly and it feels like nothing, or time feels like it's moving very slowly. But with the garden, I could watch it grow throughout the season, and that was a really good marker for me and really helped my own mental health. So in addition to growing food, I also really hope that this space can be that for other people as well, even though the pandemic is winding down and things are looking more hopeful and CDC guidelines are being revised. It's something where we are still going to experience the traumatic after effects of the pandemic, and having something like this, which is still going to be that bridge for community development, getting people outside connected to not only their local food systems but also their neighbors as well, is something that I think is really important. With a position like this, where you have a different person coming in every year, each person kind of leaves their mark and makes their own decision for how they want that position to look. And so what I really hope to do is to be able to turn this space into kind of an edible forest, and I hope to continue to build on volunteers. We typically meet for garden drop-in hours every Friday. That's 5 to 7 p.m., but if you show up a little bit earlier than that, I'm usually there at about 3, just hanging out and getting some work done and preparing the space before the work party. Or, again, if you came in there and was only able to stay for like 10 minutes or a half hour, that's also good too. You can just, again, drop in and drop out as is convenient for your schedule. And then we also have garden drop-in hours as well on Sundays, and that's going to be from 10 to 1. So for me, while I don't necessarily attend a religious service on Sundays, the garden can be, you know, quite spiritual, just being able to get outside, even in all kinds of weather, and be able to get my hands in the dirt and to have that ritual aspect.
That was Erin Johans, the new coordinator of Troy's Collard City Growers Garden, talking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's producer Sina Basila Hickey. If you want to meet Erin or get your hands dirty in the garden, come by the garden at 3337 6th Avenue in North Troy for drop-in hours on Fridays 5 to 7 p.m. and Sundays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The garden is just a couple lots down the street from the Media Sanctuary.
And that concludes our show this evening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jody Cowan.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Our engineer for the program is Sina Basila Hickey. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.